Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, June 25th. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, the Prime Minister apologizes, but will action follow?
We are sorry. It was something that we cannot undo in the past, but we can pledge ourselves every day to fix in the present and into the future.
The Prime Minister apologizes after a Saskatchewan First Nation announces the discovery of 751 unmarked graves and promises to offer any support requested by First Nations across the country. What's actually needed? In moments, we'll bring in First Nations Child and Family Caring Society's Cindy Blackstock and the mayor of Iqaluit, who wants to remove the Catholic Church's tax-exempt status. Then, Canada's flattening curve.
Average case counts have dropped by over 90% since the peak of the third wave in mid-April. The latest seven-day average for the number of people with COVID-19 being treated in our hospitals each day has dropped by almost 75% since peak activity.
Cases are down and vaccine rates continue to race up. So what can fully vaccinated Canadians look forward to this summer? We'll break it down with CTV News infectious disease specialist Dr. Abdou Sherkawi. And Derek Chauvin sentenced.
As sentenced for count one, the court commits you to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections for a period of 270 months.
Former police officer Derek Chauvin sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for the murder of George Floyd. We get the latest from Minneapolis. Plus, setting the election stage. Are the battle lines set for a campaign? Just how soon could Canadians head to the polls? We close out the season with our Friday strategy session. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. The world watched yesterday when the Cowessess First Nation shared the findings of its search of the former Maryvale Residential School, 751 unmarked graves. Cowessess First Nation Chief Cadmus Delorme says reconciliation will only prevail once the truth is told and then accepted. More searches are underway and tragically more grave sites are expected to be discovered. But key records essential to finding and identifying the children who never returned home, remain sealed. These are documents held by both the federal government and the Catholic Church. So how does the country move forward? Let's bring in key players to start things off today. Iqaluit Mayor Kenny Bell is moving a motion to remove church's land tax exemption in his city, and Cindy Blackstock, the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada. They both join me now. Welcome, Mayor Bell. Welcome, Cindy Blackstock. Nice to see you both. Mayor Bell, let me start with you. Can you explain the motion you're bringing forward about removing the church's tax exemption? And what are you looking to get out of this motion?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Joyce. And what an honor it is to be here with Cindy. Here in Iqaluit, churches have land tax exemption. And because of the gruesome past and the terrifying future that we are waiting to see, because they're refusing to apologize, I want to remove their tax exemption here in Iqaluit, and I'm hoping for other politicians and other cities to do the exact same thing.
Do you think, Mayor, that will help you and other communities get those documents from the Catholic Church?
I mean, I don't know what's going to help us do that. They've been refusing for so long now. We need to make it happen. And, the conversation is starting and we need to keep on. I mean, it's been going on for a long time, but we need to, ramp it up and start taxing them and hurting them where it hurts with their wallet. So, I think that we need to start doing this. And even the federal tax exemption needs to be removed from the churches.
Yeah, I understand. Cindy, we've heard a lot of words from the federal government about the Catholic Church, but, what about the federal government's accountability and the documents Ottawa says the Vatican has and won't share? Now, doesn't the federal government have some of those documents on residential schools you would like to see?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that's what really the whole holding back of documents is right at the center of the St. Anne's Residential School survivor case. The federal government's litigating against these survivors. Keep in mind that these survivors were also in a Catholic school and they were shocked in an electric chair, and yet Canada's litigating against them. And it all relates to this failure to disclose proper records. So Canada needs to put them on the table as well.
And what can you do, Cindy, to pressure the government to do that?
Well, I think the public needs to pressure them. And if necessary, then perhaps litigation against the federal government. Keep in mind, Joyce, that's exactly what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had to do. They had to file a legal case against the government of Canada in the closing years of the commission just to get some documents so that they could complete their report. Now, let's hope that's not going to happen, but we need to see some action from the federal government, not just a lot of words.
Mayor Bell, I want to go to another topic related, though. You're changing Canada Day celebrations. Tell us what you will be doing instead and why.
Yeah, so here in, of course, because there's not too much to celebrate. I mean, that's the easiest answer. Canada Day is a time for celebration, but we can't celebrate our country under the current circumstances. So looking into Nunavut, we're going to celebrate with some cultural events and, just take the time to spend time with each other and reflect on our time together and just kind of, celebrate the last cases of COVID here in Nunavut and just spend some time doing some cultural events and move forward that way. Because right now there's no time to celebrate Canada.
And Cindy, there are movements to not celebrate or Canada Day across the country. Do you think that sends a message to Canadians, to the government? What message does that send?
I'd like to see what the mayor is doing, like to really spend Canada Day celebrating First Nations, Métis and Inuit peoples, but also doing more than that. About really looking and learning about the TRC's calls to action and murder, missing, and Indigenous women and girls calls to justice, and getting out along with on your Twitter account or social media and letting your member of parliament know, letting your member of legislature know that your vote counts on whether or not the federal and provincial and territorial governments take the action needed to make these real in the lives of people. We can't allow the federal government to make the apology, however heartfelt it was today, and still litigate against residential school survivors and First Nations kids in court and really not do what's necessary to support First Nations, Métis and Inuit peoples across the country, even though the solutions are already on the books.
Mayor Bell, I'm wondering, the list of things that the federal government needs to do now to correct this is so long. I'm wondering if you could tell me what one priority would be. What would a first step be, an ideal first step, in your opinion?
Well, I'm gonna step back even from the federal government, and I'm gonna say that I'm asking, and I have been doing this all day. I'm asking my fellow non-Indigenous men and women to stand up with Indigenous people across our country. Canada is never going to be strong, and we're never going to succeed if we don't have a strong Indigenous population. And we have to be allies with them. They more than deserve it. They're our first people of Canada, and we need to support them wholeheartedly, and make sure that our politicians understand that we are standing together from here on out. These dead kids is heartbreaking, and everybody can understand that. And we need to make sure that this never happens again, and that people are held accountable, and the government understands that.
Mayor Kenny Bell and Cindy Blackstock, thanks so much for sharing these thoughts with us. I know it's a very difficult time, so we appreciate you being here with us today. Have yourselves a nice weekend.
Thank you, Joyce.
Thank you very much, Joyce. Thank you, Cindy.
Thanks, Mayor.
And with 26% of Canada's population considered fully vaccinated against COVID-19, many people are wondering what they can do safely. Canada's chief public health officer says guidelines are now online, providing a brief preview today.
It's things like you can now consider getting close to people without wearing a mask, taking into account the who you're meeting and the setting. You now don't have to quarantine after traveling. So that is being communicated for travel across the border now. You don't not necessarily need to quarantine after being exposed to another person with COVID-19. Now that you do have to follow the local public health advice, but that's as to the rule of thumb as well.
So basically ask the computer. The online tool will calculate vaccination status, case spread in a region, and personal health risks. And as of today, fully vaccinated Quebecers, for instance, can gather in private homes without a mask. So what will your summer look like? Let's bring in CTV News infectious disease specialist Dr. Abdou Cherkaoui to find out. Welcome, Doc. Nice to see you as usual. Maybe this time we'll have a sort of more positive conversations than our last ones. What do you make of this assessment tool? Do you think people are going to understand what they can do, fully vaccinated, non-fully half vaccinated? Did you try the tool?
I looked at the tool and, you know, I've posted on social media about it. And already judging from a lot of the questions that people have, I think it's understandable. There's never going to be a foolproof way of making it crystal clear where the boundaries are between what should be considered completely safe or not. And frankly, I don't think there should be that sort of clarity because there has to be some degree of nuance and judgment. And that's going to reflect two things. One is the exposure setting itself, and the other is the host. Is it somebody who is elderly, who's immune compromised, who maybe has a little bit less leverage when it comes to taking a chance? In that sort of situation, it's probably more reasonable to err a little bit more on the side of caution. If it's someone who's much younger and your immune system is healthier and you're dealing with a situation that is a little bit less risk-taking, then it makes sense, for example, to be able to not wear a mask and not distance if you are in an indoor setting with others who are of a similar status. So I think a lot of this is fairly commonsensical, but it's going to take some time to adjust and get used to. And I think as our vaccine status improves across the country, it's going to become a little bit more comfortable for people to get used to what feels right, what doesn't feel right. But until that time, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of gray area.
Yes, maybe a little bit too much gray area. I mean, you know, Quebec doesn't do in the subtleties, like you say, in the nuances. They say, you're twice vaccinated, you've passed those 2 weeks after your second vaccine, your friends are twice vaccinated, you can even hug without a mask. You know, it seems to be a little bit more
bold.
Of course, Dr. Tan is being more prudent.
Yeah, I think that what we really want to be careful of here is not assuming that being fully vaccinated, no matter who you are and no matter what the setting is, means that you're bulletproof. That's what we just have to be careful around. You know, for the vast majority of situations, if you are fully vaccinated beyond 2 weeks, you should be able to do almost anything. But we know that there is a small and not completely negligible risk of someone who may be older, who may be a bit more frail, who maybe is immune compromised. And if they throw caution to the wind, well, guess what? The vaccine may not fully protect you. And next thing you know, you may end up in a hospital. And we saw what happened at Foothills Hospital in Calgary. It's not impossible. It's rare, but it's not impossible. And we just want to protect those people who may be rare, but more likely to encounter these difficulties if they take too many liberties.
So I'm hearing your message, Dr. Cherkaoui, you know, be enthusiastic, but not too enthusiastic, or at least not yet. I want to thank you, you know, for your frontline work and for the time that you have spent answering our questions. Dr. Cherkaoui, have yourself a very nice weekend.
Thank you so much. Merci. Bonne fête de même.
À vous aussi. Former police officer Derek Chauvin has been sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for the 2020 murder of George Floyd.
This is based on your abuse of a position of trust and authority, and also the particular cruelty shown to George Floyd.
Chauvin was found guilty of murder and manslaughter in Floyd's death this past April. At the trial, the court heard he knelt on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes while the black man pleaded for breath. Chauvin's lawyer asked for him to be released on time served and placed on probation. Earlier today, the judge rejected a request from the defense for a new trial. And here to give us the latest is CNN's Camila Bernal. Hi, Camila. Thanks for being there. You're on the ground in Minneapolis. We heard the family and the lawyer and the lawyers. What can you tell us about the reaction there now that Chauvin has been sentenced?
Well, Joyce, overall, this 22 and a half year sentence has been well received by people here at the courthouse and people at George Floyd Square. But keep in mind that there is always going to be people who are unhappy about this verdict. If you ask Eric Nelson, Chauvin's defense attorney, or even his mother who spoke out for the first time, this is too much. The mother today in court saying that Derek Chauvin is not a violent person, saying that he is not a racist, and that any sentence for Derek Chauvin would be a sentence for her. And so they are always going to be unhappy with these 22 and a half years. On the other hand, you have to think about the Floyd family and even the judge saying you have to look at them in particular and have sympathy for them in particular because they've gone through a lot of pain over the last 13 months. They expressed even not being able to sleep. That was what Thelonious Floyd said in court over these last 13 months, taking naps because of how difficult this has been for them. They say that no matter what the sentence is, this does not bring George Floyd back. So they say even the maximum sentence would not have been enough for the Floyd family. And so a lot of reactions when it comes to this sentence. But overall, it is 22 and a half years. And keep in mind that here in the state of Minnesota, he will have to serve at least two thirds of that in prison, which means he will at least be in prison for 15 years before he's even qualified or able to qualify for things like probation. Joyce.
Well, that's CNN's Camila Bernal. Thanks for this update, Camila. Take care. Thanks for being there. And search crews in Florida are scouring through the rubble of a collapsed condo building near Miami. So far, four people are confirmed dead. Another 159 people are still unaccounted for. Florida's governor says the community needs answers about what led to the tragedy.
You have families that lost loved ones in this building collapse. They have a right to know. You have other folks who were able to get out safely, but then lost their homes. When we were walking out, one of the things that they were cleaning up were all the family photos that would be strewn around. And so they have a right to know as well. And then I think there's a lot of other people throughout this community and really throughout Florida who want to know, well, how could a building just collapse like that?
And Global Affairs is warning some Canadians may have been affected by the condo collapse. In a statement, Global Affairs says they have received preliminary reports of citizens being affected, but they have no further confirmation at this time. The building houses multiple guests, including a mix of year-round residents and part-time snowbirds. At least 159 people remain missing. And coming up, it's been 928 long days since Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor were detained in China. Are they any closer to making it back on Canadian soil? Both men have stood trial, but their verdicts remain unknown. What comes next in the fight to bring them home? We talk to Vina Najibula, Michael Kovrig's wife, next. Stay with us. And welcome back. 928 days. That's how long Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor have been detained in China in what is widely viewed as retaliation for the arrest of Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou. Are Kovrig and Spavor any closer to coming home than they were 928 days ago? Both are awaiting verdicts from their trials, which were cloaked in secrecy. But with Canada staring down a potential election, where does that leave our next guest's fight to bring Michael Kovrig home? Let's find out. And Vina Najibullah joins me now. Vina, welcome to Power Play. Thanks for joining us and you know, be willing to answer our questions. So what can you tell us about how Michael Kovrig is doing, how his health is? Is he getting his consular visits? Has he gotten his vaccine, his morale? Give us some news.
Thank you, Joy. Joyce, it's good to be with you again. And thank you so much for covering the story and reminding Canadians that Michael and Michael Spavor are still unjustly detained in China. In terms of Michael's health, we know through consular visits, which are continuing on a monthly basis, these are virtual visits, that he is healthy and he is, you know, doing everything he can to stay mentally and physically strong. He's continuing with his regimen of physical exercise. He's continuing with reading and song lyrics, all of the things that he's been doing for the last 2.5 years to stay mentally and physically as strong as he can, given the circumstances.
Is he able to get news from home? Does he know what's going on in the outside world?
Yeah, so these consular visits are the main way that he can get immediate information. Those are 30 minutes and once a month. In addition to that, we're able to send him letters, but those usually take some months to get to him. So he does eventually get them, but there's a long delay, and there's only so much one can say in those letters. But he has a general idea that we've been living through a pandemic, that it has been an incredibly incredibly difficult thing to even describe to him. And he also knows that we're getting vaccines. So I was able to tell him that we're getting there, that there's light at the end of the tunnel. And he's certainly happy to hear that, that the pandemic might be finally over or soon.
He has been vaccinated. Do you know that?
I don't think so. I don't believe so. But from what we understand, they're quite a strong protection. Sort of the reason why the consular visits are virtual is in part because of the pandemic protocols that are in place. So, but I don't think he has been vaccinated.
So, you know, last time we spoke, he had his secret trial on espionage charges. So far, we have no verdict, no sentence. Do you know where that process stands? Is he waiting for a verdict? Are we expecting something, or is this just suspended?
No, so the trials, as you said, were 3 months ago, and there is no verdict yet, but that can take time. There is no deadline for that. And as we had said back then, there's no real question about the verdict because 99% of them are a guilty charge. So that's really not the issue. The focus has been before the trial and continues to be today on how do we get them out, right? So our efforts must be on finding a resolution to this and ending his detention. The outcome is not going to be through a legal verdict, not at least one that would allow him to come home.
So I just have a last question, because since we last spoke, Canada-China relations are more tense than ever. You know, the House adopted a motion calling the treatment of the Muslim Uyghur minority in China a genocide. Canada was also the architect of the Declaration Against Arbitrary Detention. Dozens of countries signed on to it. It was covered all over the place, angering China even more. And you always told us, you always told me that you had to remain positive and hopeful. When you look at the big diplomatic picture, are you still hopeful that this will have a political resolution or diplomatic one?
It has to have a political and diplomatic resolution. There is no other way to bring Michael home. And this government, our government here in Ottawa, has said that bringing Michael home is a priority. It was in their throne speech. It is something that has been on the agenda for now more than 2 years. And so far, that promise has not been fulfilled. And I hope that we will do everything possible to bring them home and finally deliver on that commitment.
We are all hoping with you, Vina Najibullah. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you. Thank you, Joyce.
And coming up, overcoming a pandemic, unfinished business, toxicity and obstruction as the House adjourned for the summer and with speculation that it won't return this fall due to an early election call. How will the 43rd session of Parliament be remembered? We'll bring in our panel of Hill Hawks to break it all down. Stay with Power Play. After the House adjourned on Wednesday, MPs are now back at their home for their summer break. But will it really be a break? MPs will be returning to their home ridings with the cloud of a looming election hanging over their heads. That's not a surprise since the spring sitting left on a stormy note. Accusations of obstruction and toxicity from the Prime Minister, the censuring of National Defence Minister Harjit Sajjan, and the admonishing of the head of the Public Health Agency of Canada. So, as parliamentarians prepare to not return to the Hill this fall, what business did the House leave unfinished? Let's find out. And joining us now are Rachel Aiello, CTV News online parliamentary reporter, and Susan Delacourt, the Toronto Star's national columnist. Welcome to both of you. Happy Friday. Nice to see you. Susan, I'm going to start with you because the Liberals are saying they can't govern since Parliament has become paralyzed by a toxic environment, obstruction from the opposition, but really mainly the Conservatives. But the Liberals have managed to pass legislation this past year despite the restraints of governing in a minority government. So do you buy the Liberals' claim an excuse to go to an election that they can't govern?
I don't buy the idea that we are totally ungovernable. In fact, I think this last year has proven a lot can get done despite contrary circumstances. I do buy the idea, and I've been around politics a long time, as you know, that majority rule is easier than minority rule. I was around in the summer of the year of 2011 when Stephen Harper went to the public with the voters with the same argument, which is, and his was phrased, "Give me a strong, stable majority," on banking or gambling on the belief that Canadians really want stability in Parliament. I think that's what you're going to hear from the Prime Minister if he does pull the plug on an election. It's not that the country is ungovernable, but it is not stable and it is not predictable.
Rachel, well, unpredictable that it is. So the Liberals prioritized four bills to get passed before the summer break: the budget implementation bill, the ban on LGBTQ conversion therapy, a bill on net zero emissions, and the controversial updates on the Broadcasting Act. So the House managed to pass all these bills. It's in the Senate now. What are the chances they get through the Senate now?
Well, that's going to be something we watch play out Monday and Tuesday of next week. The Senate's extended their sitting, so they'll be dealing with those bills then. In terms of the budget implementation bill and the climate bill, the Senate was pre-studying those in advance of them passing. So of the four, those two are the most likely to get through without any issue, without the concern of rubber stamping. When it comes to the broadcasting bill, we've already heard from senators from the Conservative caucus who have concerns and want to do basically the opposite of a rubber stamp. They want to spend a lot of time getting into this, and right now it doesn't look like they will have the time to do that. So that's one bill that I'm not sure is going to make it through. But in that case, Joyce, I don't necessarily know that that's a bad thing for the Liberals. They will then have in the election the ability to say, you know, we really tried to get this through, but the Conservatives were spreading misinformation about it in the House, and then their senators blocked it in the upper chamber. And the conversion therapy bill is one I will be watching very closely. I don't know yet how that's going to go. It was a slow move, fair to say, through the House, and ended up with the Conservatives in majority rejecting it, still getting through. So TBD, I would say, on that one.
Interesting. And they will definitely be campaigning on those bills, especially the Broadcast Act modernization in Quebec. So, but Susan, the NDP said they would help prop up the Liberal government since, you know, they don't want an election called during a pandemic. So how well do you think this unofficial coalition managed in this sitting?
I think, as I was saying, I think that that Canada has proven, or Parliament has proven, it can do things when it sets its mind to it. And I think there's not a bad relationship between the Prime Minister, the Prime Minister of the Liberal Party, and the NDP. I don't know how sustainable that is, and I don't know that I don't know that's a case for keeping this Parliament alive. I've been really intrigued by what bills what Rachel was saying about the priority bills and whether they pass or not, and whether it matters whether they pass or not. If you look at how the Liberals won the last election, they won it by micro-targeting communities. So all of these bills and all of the things they haven't done yet are intended to certain communities where they need to a target demographic to win their majority. So you can't look at all of these bills as sort of a body of work. They are micro-targeted to mathematical precision what the Liberals want to get when they eventually go to the polls.
Well, give us an example of these micro-targets.
Oh, well, Quebec is a perfect one. C-10, as you said, the Broadcast Act, was incredibly problematic for Conservatives outside Quebec. Inside Quebec, that bill, one of the rare things you've seen is a unanimous vote in the National Assembly in favor of passage of C-10. So Quebec is going to be a big battleground in this election, and that bill is intended for that battleground. And, you know, we've seen in the last week, Bill Blair has come out with gun control again. That was a big issue in 2019. It is a big issue in cities like my newspaper represents. So even though they haven't passed it, they will go to the public with, look, we've got these bills that are intended at your specific concerns.
So Rachel, in their push to prioritize those four bills, what other bills stood out that have essentially been left to die on the order paper?
So two things, Joyce. First, just to Susan's point, it is abundantly clear that the four bills that they pushed through as priorities are more than just the bill itself, right? It's when you look at this government as a whole, if we are going into an election, they want to know and be able to say, this is what we were able to do outside of pandemic legislation. So something for the environment, something for the queer community, something for the broadcasters. Like, they were clearly wanting to make sure that they were making good on those commitments. And in terms of what was languishing, we also saw them try to make up for that. So the gun control measures that Bill Blair was talking about at the end of this week, Melanie Joly with language changes, the Justice Minister with things on criminal reform. These are bills that were put up at the 11th hour, were never going to pass, but they wanted to kind of put them in the window. And so these are things that they will continue to talk about and maybe try to use this argument of, we couldn't get these through, though I'm not sure that's really going to hold water because it doesn't look like they tried all of that hard. But all of these things are key Liberal talking points, promises, commitments to various groups. And so we definitely saw them kind of putting the pieces in place over the last 2 weeks, trying to at least either get things through or look like they were trying to. And so some of the other stuff that's been left languishing, Privacy Act changes, elections bill, which apparently Elections Canada says they don't actually need to run a pandemic election, so keep that in mind as well. And a few others that they have tried to come at in different ways in recent days to kind of make up for the fact that the promise in legislation is still sitting in the House.
Yeah, look for those in their campaign, in the Liberal campaign speeches. But I want to ask you both, I don't have a lot of time, but what do you think will be the ballot question if indeed we do have, you know, if they decide to go to an election? Say we start an election in August, just to throwing a month out there. Susan, let's start with you. What will be the ballot question?
So there are two forces in politics, to put it really succinctly, hope and fear. We have had 14 months, 16 months, I've lost track of fear. And I think the voters are going to, I think all the parties are going to want to be the champion of hope. What is post-pandemic hope? what does it look like?
Yeah, Rachel.
I think that, and also, who do you want to lead us through an economic recovery? The other aspect of this, we've been focused really a lot on the health well-being of Canadians and now the vaccine rollout. But the kind of other outstanding question is the economy. And I think that's going to be the driving factor. As much as the Prime Minister is setting up this question of Parliament is toxic and we can't get legislation through, as much as me and the other nerds would love for the legislative agenda to be what sets us into an election and Canadians are seized on, that is not going to be the case.
Yep, we all have to agree on that. Susan Delacourt, Rachel Aiello, wonderful to have you here. Thanks for being there. Have yourselves a wonderful weekend.
Have a great summer.
And a great summer. And we just looked back at the year on the Hill. Now let's look forward. When do the politicos and pundits think a federal election will be called? And what do they think is at stake? Our panel of strategists will join us to dig in. Stay with us. And welcome back. Election speculation is a popular pastime on the Hill, but now that the House is out for the summer break and the country is opening back up, is Canada one step closer to heading back to the polls? Let's bring in our panel of strategists for the last strategy session of the season. We will miss them. Greg McCachran from Proof Strategies leans liberal. The Toronto Sun's editor-in-chief, Adrian Batra, has a conservative perspective. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director. And Greg Weston from Ernst Cliff Strategy Group is our neutral voice. Welcome and happy Friday to the four of you. I want to start with you, Greg McCachran, because you have the liberal crystal ball, I think. And if indeed we do go to an election, and I said it's a big if, will they run on the handling of the pandemic and, you know, their handling coming next of the economy?
I think that it's what is primarily on people's minds is the pandemic and the reaction and what is next. Your previous panel talked about some of the other bills that might be used as wedge issues around, you know, the environment or social justice. But I think right now, if you look at the polls, the government's doing really well. Their approval rates are up. The prime minister's approval rate is up. They're polling really well. And if you look at what they've done recently, they had a little bit of a secret weapon. And the prime minister's office established a COVID response war room in April. They didn't do it with a lot of fanfare. They didn't put out an announcement, which I think is a good thing. It's better rather to announce things and keep announcing them, just do it over and over again. And I think if you look at their numbers, this is where they started to track upwards. I remember being on this show in February, Joyce. It was not fun. You know, vaccines were late. I kept saying, like, let's take a look at the quarter numbers. And they exceeded those numbers and continued to exceed them. But I think they took a page out of their U.S.-Canada war room that they had in PMO to handle, you know, Donald Trump, trade issues, et cetera. They did that, and establishing a COVID response war room in PMO, they had four dedicated people to this. I think this brought a lot of discipline, and I think, you know, obviously the benefit is Canadians if we're getting vaccinated ahead of schedule.
So, Adrian, let's talk about that strategy, because in the last few weeks, the Liberals have been accusing the Conservatives of creating a toxic atmosphere in Parliament and not allowing them to get their legislation passed, although it has gotten passed. So is and do you think it's the right time for Erin O'Toole to take his troops to an election?
Well, I don't know if there's ever a perfect time, but I would say that the Conservatives are certainly ready for one. The war chest is full. They've got candidates ready to go. And they have a leader who is got a very difficult job and a big job ahead of him. He's contending with contending against a prime minister who has had free time every single day to be in front of Canadians, trying to look responsible, trying to look like he has a handle on the pandemic. So Erin O'Toole and frankly, all the other opposition leaders have an uphill battle to make the case to Canadians why the Trudeau Liberals weren't prepared back in 2020 for the pandemic, or at the very least, aren't able to help recover from the economy, which was challenged even before the pandemic. That's the case that Aaron O'Toole is going to have to make. And I think he can do it. And then there's also that little niggling point that seems to be coming up over and over again with the Trudeau Liberals, and that's with respect to ethics breaches and trust in government. And so they can blame the Conservatives as much as they want for so-called parliamentary discord, but ultimately, they're the ones that still managed to get past their some contentious bills, like C-10, for example. They got those through. That sort of saber-rattling, I don't think, works in Canada. It might work in the United States when the Democrats say the Republicans are holding up everything in the House and the Senate. I just don't think that works here. And your previous panel, basically, I would agree with them with respect to that, Joyce. But ultimately, an election, when it comes, the Conservatives will be ready for it.
And McGrath, I like to say that in a lot of ways, Jagmeet Singh was a bit of the grown up in the room when he said even before the budget that he was not going to vote against it. This is not the time for an election. He got, a few bills changed in the discussions. He was an ally, really, of this minority Liberal government. How is he going to distinguish himself now in a campaign from the Liberals and get those soft Liberal votes?
So first of all, Joyce, we are still in a pandemic, and so there should not be an election this summer or this fall. That said, there most likely will be one, because I think the Liberals are going to take us to the polls the minute they think that they can get a majority and they can get away with calling an election, and they'll come up with whatever excuse they need to. A year and a half ago, or a year ago, people would have said the reason that the NDP thought that there shouldn't be an election was because we weren't ready. Nobody can argue that now. The NDP is totally ready, but does not believe that an election should be triggered during a pandemic purely for partisan political purposes and to get a majority government. So, I think that what Jagmeet has been doing has been to help people. And all the way along throughout this minority parliament, he has pushed the Liberals to do more than they probably wanted to do. But there are things that people really have benefited from, like CERB, the wage subsidy, all the other supports. I think that he's got a good track record to run on, but still believes that the election should not be held while we are still in a pandemic.
Greg Wesson, I mean, you've seen this movie before. Okay, maybe not in a pandemic. That was a first for all of us. But you've seen this movie with minority governments. Nobody wants to be in a minority government. You want to go for a majority. Is this a cynical, Anne just said, the pandemic is still on. We may be all very optimistic, but there is still a pandemic. Is this a cynical move? Do voters actually punish governments for going to an election for reasons that they don't understand or they don't even see?
Well, Joyce, I'm going to answer that with something from recent history. We'll recall that Stephen Harper, after three successive minority governments, actually, you'll recall in 2015, went to the polls, and his entire reason was a strong, stable majority. In other words, if you don't want more elections every 2 years, vote for us. I mean, that's about as feeble as it gets, and they won. And by the way, they got a pretty good majority. So, in minority situations, minority governments rarely last more than a couple of years. We're at that mark. Will Canadians punish the Liberals if they say, yeah, look, the only reason we're going to the polls is because we think this is good for us? They're not going to do that. Usually it's an issue for a couple of days, 3 days, but they do need a narrative, which is why we're hearing all this noise about, and this is the classic, we've heard it over and over and over again over the decades, Parliament is dysfunctional and the opposition is tying everything up and we need a mandate. There is a very strong message that the Liberals can use in this, and I would not be at all shocked if they do. And that is, listen, we're coming out of the pandemic. Now we're moving to recovery. This is a whole new game. And if you look at our budget and our planning and the rest of it, this is looking ahead. Generally speaking, people, as soon as that writ is dropped, people stop looking backwards and start looking forwards. With a pandemic behind us by the end of this summer, hopefully, I think the agenda is for the election is going to be set, as Susan Delacourt said, looking forward, not backwards.
So let me go. I have 1 minute. So just give me a yes or no or a month. Greg McCachran, will there be an election this summer and when? What do you think?
I used to be a Hunt for Red October guy, but it's a long runway. I think we're looking more and more like a summer election.
Adrian, summer election?
The red drops in August, and I think there'll be a September E-Day.
Oh, my God. Anne McGrath?
The minute they think they can get away with it.
Okay.
Good answer, Anne.
That says a lot.
Good answer.
Greg Weston, what's your guess?
My bets are riding on August 15th call. That's a Sunday for election on Monday, September the 20th. How's that for going on a creaking limb?
Okay, well, that's our last Strat session anyway before the next election or the next television season, whatever comes first. Greg McCachran, Adrian, and Greg Weston, thanks for joining us. Thanks for the time you have spent with us. You guys rock. Have yourselves a wonderful summer.
Thank you.
And that's your Power Play Day in politics and a wrap on our season finale. Thank you to each and every one of you at home for joining us this year. We're going to take a summer break and return at the beginning of September. But if an election is called, we'll be back right here with you as soon as those writs drop. And we'd like to wish the best of luck to our wonderful director, Neil McCourt, who is departing after nearly 36 years with CTV. Bye, Neil.